84864, Milton Burstay. Counsel, you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You ready, sir?
Yes, Justice.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Justice. Good morning, Justices. Joseph Reif on behalf of Appellant Wendell Melton, a man who did not receive a fair trial. And he was destined to not receive a fair trial. There was an omen in this case, and I'll go right to it and I'll circle back to it, Justices. And we talked about it, but we didn't go into the degree that I'm going to talk about it, although briefly. Prospective juror 535 during jury selection was asked to go before the court and the parties, and he was granted that request. And he came before the court and he said, I'm a homosexual, and being in this courtroom, I think is making me very uncomfortable. Judge says, okay. And he says, I don't think I can make this a fair trial. And I want to give this man a fair trial. And the court says, okay, you had a type of a breakdown the night before. Okay, you're fine, leave. No questions were ever asked. But I want the justices to focus in on what he was saying. He wasn't saying, I can't do it. He's telling the court, it can't happen here. And I don't want to be part of this. And I want this man to have a fair trial. His statements portended what was going to happen. And it did happen. And I will circle back to that. And that was part of Mr. Melton's issue with regard to what was said and done in the antics of Victoria Melton, the decedent's victim's mother, and the court's refusal to rein in her activity.
Counsel, was there any questioning of the juror to connect up that juror's feelings about the proceedings to the comments of Ms. Melton?
Really appreciate you asking me that question because I forgot to point that out. No, the court ignored it, stuck its head in the sand, and didn't say what's going on. If there ever was a red light, there it went off.
Was counsel precluded from asking any questions?
No, they weren't. Nobody was. Nobody asked. And he went on his merry way. Well, I wouldn't say merry. Okay, so the first issue we brought up, judges, justices, is that the numbers of the jury did not grant my client was precluded from his 6th and 14th Amendment right of a representative jury. And I won't go too far into depth on that because I want limited time, but as they say, liars figures, but the figures do not lie. And the figures that we use are in lockstep with what Williams told us to do.
Counsel was given an opportunity to challenge the cross section and run a motion and counsel, isn't that correct?
Pardon?
Counsel was given an
opportunity. Oh, yes, yes,
counsel was given an opportunity and didn't challenge or chose not to challenge.
That's correct. And in a sense, and what the state argues is that he waived that. And what we are saying in this appeal is that you don't waive constitutional rights. In fact, U.S. constitutional law, as well as NRS 178.602, says that Sixth Amendment right, 14th Amendment right, doesn't go by the boards just because counsel doesn't question the jury commissioner. Nevertheless, when the state, in their responding brief to our numbers, with regard to the first prong, they said, okay, he's a distinctive class. With respect to the second prong, was the defendant compromised by those numbers? And the numbers that we use, the most important number is the absolute disparity. The absolute disparity in Williams tells us if it goes over 51%, there's a big problem. And what that means is 51, and ours was, if it goes over 50, ours was 51%. And the problem is that tells, that number represents that there's a 51% more likelihood that African Americans aren't being summoned. And they're not being summoned. And how do we prove that? The third prong, we gave the statistical analysis.
I think it would be helpful if you addressed the jury question. The jury question about the instruction.
Oh, sure. Thank you, Justice. There were 8 pages of dialogue between the court, Mr. Palau, Mr. Villani for the state, Ms. McNeil, and Jonathan MacArthur. And in those 8 pages, if you look closely, Who was mum? Nearly mum. It was the only man that was thinking, the only person that was doing the real thinking that had to be applied in this situation. Who was doing the analytical thinking? It was Jonathan MacArthur. Because the judge at the onset said, look, I got this question, but I never answer questions. And I'm not going to, she went on to say, I'm not going to answer this question. Fine, you don't want to answer the question. Good. But that's not okay in the sense that Jeffries versus State says, you don't have to answer the question, but you better give further instructions whenever during deliberations, the question triggers a suggests is the word from Jeffries, suggests either confusion or misunderstanding of a fundamental law and the element within that law here, felony murder rule, then you have to. The judge has a duty to expound upon the instruction so that confusion is mitigated.
Well, did defense counsel proffer a different instruction or one that would have answered the jury's question?
He absolutely did. And when you look down at the transcript, Judge, what was going on is it is really, really confusing, that instruction. It says, look, felony murder rule, forget about an accident. You're guilty if in the perpetration or attempt of perpetration of child abuse, we don't care. Throw accident out the window. Then you get down the bottom. Hey, if there's an accident, there is no felony murder rule. And so the jury's saying, what the heck is this all about? Ms. McNeil.
What was the proffered clarifying answer that defense counsel gave?
Mr. MacArthur said, look at the second sentence, because there were five sentences. The first two and the last two created the perceived contradiction. And everybody would look at first blush and say, that is a contradiction. It doesn't make any sense. You have to look at it closely to break it down. But if you do, and what it stands for, the instruction stands for, look, if it's child abuse, we're not worried about accident. So if you look at the third sentence, which is what Jonathan MacArthur said after he was mum, and the judge said, and everyone was on board, let's just make it sweep it under the rug, let's make it go away, and just give him this try harder charge. And Mr. MacArthur said, wait, that's not what we should do. Well, what should we do? I'm trying. And finally he came up with, he said, look at sentence number three, the middle sentence, because if you look at that, that's going to tell you what child abuse is. And if you don't have child abuse, then the felony murder rule is not implicated. And yet the court did not adopt it. And
how did that harm your client?
Pardon me?
How did that harm your client?
Because the jury, you have a jury that's telling the court, we don't know what this even means. And when you look at this case, Mr. Melton, there was never any motive that was sought. Why did he, if he intentionally, or he went there to kill his son, what was that all about? How did that happen? And so was there an accident, which is what his testimony was. I never intended to do this. So this issue of accident is just, it's overreaching in terms of what's going on in this case. And the jury's trying to figure that out. And they're scratching their head and they're told, look, we're saying we don't know, we don't understand this law. It contradicts us. We need some help. And what did the instruction that the judge sent back? The judge said, refer to the instructions. In other words, refer to the things.
MacArthur's suggestion, though? MacArthur's suggestion was direct their attention to the center sentence.
That's correct.
And so the court said then look at the instruction.
Instruction is plural.
Yeah, so the court
basically didn't help him, didn't help the jury whatsoever. If you're a juror, you're going to say, what? You're going to be.
That were the case or error, why isn't it non-constitutional error? Under Tortinas.
With regard to the instruction?
Mm-hmm.
Well, is it a non-constitutional error is the question?
Is it a constitutional error or is it a non-constitutional error as the judge mishandled the instruction? The instruction wasn't incorrect.
Well, the plain error from the perspective of the appellant is that the judge had a duty under Jeffries to clarify or to further instruct. And whether it was rose to the level of constitutional or not,
I'm trying to get to the fact that perhaps it's harmless error.
Well, and that's...
If it's non-constitutional error.
Right, I understand that. And if the... It went to the heart of the jury's deliberations to determine whether or not how this killing occurred. And it was the defense's position at all times. This was an accident. And the jury doesn't know, the jury's left with, I submit to the court, that it doesn't matter whether it's an accident or not, because it says it right in here in this instruction that we don't understand. So we're walking away from it. And therefore, if it's an accident, he's guilty of felony murder. End of story. The young man that I talked about, justices, that made that statement, that came, when he walked out, the next topic of discussion brought out by Mr. MacArthur was, Judge, I want to address Miss Mountain's misdeeds and what is going on. And by the way, and he talked about how she has been warned twice. And the marshal told the court that I have had to admonish her on two separate occasions about not talking about this case in front of the presence of the jury.
Is there evidence that she was discussing this in front of the jury after the jury was sworn? And I presume the jury was admonished not to look at news reports, social media, and disregard things heard outside of court.
The evidence is what the marshal reported to the court, that he told her twice based upon him.
He told her. What evidence is there that jurors heard Miss Milton, reviewed her statements in social media, or were affected by them?
Well, one of the prospective jurors talked about he had seen that on the news. The seated jurors. Well, I don't know. I can't say that I know for certain that when the marshal related to the court that he heard her, whatever she said, to the in the presence of the jurors, whether those jurors were, and I think, I'm not certain whether or not they were impaneled or not at that point in time. But the what's really important is he never said that she denied it. He never said that Miss Mountain, you can't do what you're doing. And if you do, and this is the second time I'm telling you that, we're going to remove you from this building. He never came back in the court and said that she denied it, which is the first thing the person's going to say is.
Even if she agreed, I'm saying that. Where's the evidence in the record that the jury either heard it or was influenced by it? Where's the questioning of the jurors? Where's the admonishment, from the court in some other way as it relates to the jurors? Because Miss Melton is an individual separate than this.
I understand that, Justice. And the court asked a broad, open-ended question. Has anybody heard anything outside of what you've heard in this courtroom? Nobody answered. Okay, so that, has anybody heard anything out in the hallways? Has anybody that's in communication with this court that's seen him, the judge could have got to what the concern was. Is my time expired?
You have a minute 30 left if you want.
Oh, that's what that says.
For rebuttal.
I saw 30. I thought that meant 30. Okay. And I want to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
We're already into your 3 minutes. You have a minute and 15 left.
Okay. I'll reserve that for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Binu Palal. I represent the respondent in this matter. I'm just going to jump right into it. The first thing that appellate counsel stated was talking about prospective juror 535 and how that was an omen as to what was to come. But I think what was more ominous is the record represented by the appellant in his briefing with regards to juror number 535. Because what the leap and the lever of which all these assumptions about the effect of Ms. Melton's conduct is comes largely from juror number 535. And the representation by the appellant is, well, the jury had never heard, the prospective jury had never heard anything about the victim in this case being gay. And that is factually incorrect. If you would turn, I mean, in the record, juror number 535 makes that representation on day two of trial, before jury selection starts on day two. On day one, at respondents' appendix, page 176, the state clearly asks about this specific issue before juror number 535 mentions it. The state says, one thing you will likely hear during the course of the trial is that the victim in this case was gay. And one thing that I have to make sure of is the fact that he was gay is not going to impact your decision. That is to say, he deserves no more or less justice than any other person. Does anybody have a problem with the fact that the victim in this case was gay? So in the respondent's appendix 176, before prospective juror 535 raises this issue is already in the court. And so I would caution this court to please examine carefully the record with regards to the representations the party makes, because the state's position is some of the record is loosely referred to. Now, I know, Justice, you refer to the instruction, and I think that is something that the appellate counsel spent a lot of time with, but I think he's conflating the obligations articulated in Gonzalez versus Jeffries. In Gonzalez, this court said when a jury evinces some kind of misunderstanding of an element of the crime, then it is not sufficient for a judge to say, merely refer back to the instructions, even if the instructions accurately represent the law. In Gonzalez, though, you had both parties offer an instruction that answered the question specifically. In Gonzalez, the question was, if a person has no knowledge of a conspiracy, but their actions contribute to someone else's plan, are they guilty of a conspiracy? And both the state and defense counsel said the answer to that is no, right? You have to know about the conspiracy. Then Jeffries came along, which is distinct, because in Jeffries, neither party proffered an answer to a question where the jury appeared confused about what consists of malice aforethought. And this court stated, a court does not abuse its discretion if neither party provides the court with a proffered instruction that would clarify the jury's doubt or confusion.
Well, his point is that one of the co-counsel for the defense effectively did proffer an instruction, and I may be mischaracterizing it, but when they said, look, the jury needs to focus on the third sentence, this about non-accidental child abuse, in interpreting that instruction, and they're saying that qualifies as a proffer. Can you comment on that?
Yes, okay, and taking one brief step back, I think I would ask this court to refer to the actual instruction, because it wasn't one jumbled one paragraph. And in fact,
it's three paragraphs.
And Mr. MacArthur during the course of argument says, well, what if we tell them that the second paragraph explains the difference between the first and the third paragraph? That was his proffered instruction. But his co-counsel immediately after that says, that's what we're saying, is read it as a whole on the respondent's appendix 1103. And that is the last word from the defense. Ms. McNeil saying, that is what we are saying. And, you know, it strikes me as if we were to say that, well, if two different defense co-counsel on the defense side gets to offer two different theories, I think it gives a perverse incentive of, well, we'll just take two different positions and see which one lands and which way. If the judge rules this way, we've at least preserved this appeal for because the other person said it. But I think in reality, how the transcript reads is Mr. MacArthur saying on respondents appendix 1102, there's three paragraphs. They think one and three are contradictory. Two explains how one and three are not contradictory. If we provide them with that information, we're not. That is the whole of Mr. MacArthur's explanation. That's it.
That kind of is the key that unlocks that jury instruction. I mean, at the end of the day, you want the jury to correctly apply the law.
Right. And then immediately after, without intervention of the courts or the state, the next person that says something is co-counsel, Ms. McNeil. That's what we're saying. Read it as a whole. And that is what the instruction that the judge ultimately gave.
Well, they said read the instructions as a whole, or that instruction as a whole?
I think it was read the instructions as a whole. You are to read the instructions as a whole. And the
without an S on instruction.
I believe it is with an S. Read the instructions as a whole. So given that, the state's position is that there was no proper, the actual proper instructions, read the instruction or instructions as a whole, and the state agrees with that. And the state and the defense come to an agreement immediately after the court says, okay, that's the one I'm going to give. But addressing the issue of whether or not this is this error is actually meaningful, you need look no further than the jury's decision on count two. Because count two is the actual underlying felony which these jurors are asking about. And in count two, which is the non-accidental shooting of the victim in this case, the jury also finds him guilty of that. This argument would be far more compelling if the jury had found the defendant not guilty of count two, therefore saying, well, you know, we don't know exactly if the jury was confused or not confused. But they find him guilty of the underlying felony, the felony murder rule. So they've had to reach guilty in count two, they had to determine as a matter of law that this shooting was non-accidental.
What do we do with the district court's failure to make any findings on the deadly weapon enhancement? What do we do with Mendoza-Lobos?
So that is, you know, I'm not, the record is what it is, and I can't supplement it. What I will say is in Mendoza-Lobo, this court did say, 1 minute, please. This court did say in its ruling, in that case, there was no real record made about the individual factors.
At least she said I read the factors.
Yes, that is true.
There are factors.
That is true, but she doesn't make, in that case, the judge did not rule on the individual factors, which is what the statute actually says. And what this court said was, however, there is nothing in the record that indicates that this district court's failure to make certain findings on the record had any bearing on the district court's sentencing decision. And I think the same thing is true here. The other thing, and it's a little far afield, but the other thing I would say is that also in that very decision, this court said in ruling on whether the constitutionality of NRS 193.165, this court said it is a violation of the separation of powers. Nevertheless, we instruct the courts to follow the rule.
Right. They said you can't make us, but we're going to make
it. Yes, right? Yes. And so I would you know, gently ask this court to, if it is indeed a separation of powers issue where this comes from, the shibboleth of saying I have considered these factors does not add anything meaningful to the record, especially for a trial judge who sat through 7 days of trial, heard extensive argument, and read memorandums, had a PSI and read a defense memorandum on the case. I will say, though, I mean, certainly as the law as it stands, the court certainly, if inclined, could remand for the sole purpose of articulating that the judge had considered the factors. But again, nothing in the record indicates that that articulating that would have changed the sentencing at all. One thing I think is also important to bring up is I really want to clarify the record regarding Veronica Melton's actions. So the appellant is asking for prior restraint of speech when specifically talking about Veronica Melton, a person who's not a party or participant in the case. She's simply not. And the speculative claim that she had some impact on the jury is not borne out by anything in the transcript.
Well, there's some real disruptive conduct during that. Didn't somebody get dragged out in their wheelchair?
So yes,
outburst in the courtroom in front of the jury.
Yes, and so that is a different issue. So, and I think part of the problem is these three issues are combined, but really there are three separate issues. So there's the Veronica Melton issues where she's outside in the hallway during, and both of these instances occur during the jury selection process, where the marshal doesn't say, hey, she's infecting the jury with her theory of the case as posited by the appellant. Instead, the marshal says, I saw two people talking about the case outside. I instructed them they're not allowed to do that. But he makes a specific record, but they're nowhere near my prospective jury. They're all the way down the hall. That is my policy. And so he makes a record, the marshal makes a record, that this does not have an impact on the case. Now, so you have Veronica Melton's activities. Then you also have Clara Gossett's, which is the outburst in court. And certainly, you know, that is, you know, that doesn't require a gag order. It just, it's just conduct that should not happen in a courtroom. I would agree. But there is nothing to reflect that that had any impact on the trial. And in fact, what's notable is that Mr. MacArthur or Ms. McNeil, neither of them sought a mistrial based on this. They didn't think the conduct was so egregious that it required them seeking a mistrial. They even took it a step further. The court actually asked, and it was discussed, whether or not some kind of remedial instruction would be important or useful to the jury. And both the state deferred to defense counsel, but the defense counsel said, no, we don't want that. We don't think it's necessary. And in recounting what was said, the judge said she didn't hear it. She just saw Ms. Gossett's being escorted out of the courtroom. Ms. McNeil, who's conducting the direct examination, didn't hear it. The state heard some mumbling, but mostly the actual activities. It was the marshal and Mr. MacArthur who actually heard what was being said. And so there's nothing to indicate that there was any impact. Also notably, the court, the marshal immediately removed her from the courtroom. And in a similar incident discussed by this court in, one second, please. In a similar incident discussed by this court in Smith v. State, 137 Nev 965. In 2021, there was two victim parents during the course of jury selection made outbursts during trial. And one of the things this court stated was, here the court marshals removed both of the victim's parents after the incidents, signaling to the jury that the outbursts were inappropriate. So there's no request for a mistrial. There's no request for a remedial instruction. And the person who made these statements was immediately removed from trial. I guess the last thing I'll address, unless this court has further questions, is the jury pool issue. I just want to clarify that, you know, there's three prongs, obviously, distinctive group, no issue there. Not a fair representation, and talking about absolutely comparative disparity. I think that appellate misstates the law when he says 50% is an absolute certainty that there is an issue with representation. And in fact, Williams, which borrows the language from Evans, which borrows the language from State v. Lopez, an Idaho case, says that a comparative disparity of about 50% may or may not be adequate to show such underrepresentation, depending in part upon the size of the group in question. And what the Idaho court recognized in that is you're going to get greater variance when the percentage of the population is smaller. And so here we have 50.96, essentially 50%. So I'm not even sure that number two of the prong, the second prong is met, but certainly the third isn't, right? And what this court has repeatedly said, it is structural error not to grant an evidentiary hearing. The reason why, that is the form in which these facts are to be tested, determined, and reached. And that opportunity was given to Mr. MacArthur, and Mr. MacArthur didn't just pass on the opportunity. He made a very clear record. He said, I am not challenging the process. I see the improvements that we've made in the past less than a decade, and I don't think it's flawed. He makes an affirmative representation that this system is not flawed. And so, and I do not believe that appellant can then say, well, here's what I would have presented in the record had I been given that opportunity and thus considered it. This is not a place to expand the record. It's to deal with the record as is.
And I have a separate question, and your time's running out. I want to circle back to the jury question. Yes. And you made an argument orally that there, if there was one, couldn't have harmed, there was no harm because look at the verdict that was returned. Mm. That argument is not in the brief, and there's no argument about harmlessness in the brief by the state. And I was concerned about the Belcher case and how you would have us address that.
Well, I guess I would say that it is apparent on its face that from the record itself, that when the jury convicts somebody of the underlying felony, that the felony itself, saved by the bell, the felony itself, the underlying felony in the first degree murder is found correctly. So it would be harmless.
Okay, may I ask a follow-up?
Of course.
So you would say that then the verdict, it's not a species of harmful or harmless analysis, rather it's the final conclusion demonstrates that it in fact did not have an effect.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Counsel, I'll give you an additional minute.
Thank you. Mr. MacArthur said that he thinks this system is okay. That means he doesn't know. And he found out, well, if you read this, that it's not and it is flawed. Separately, instruction number 17, what happened? The jurors conflated child abuse and the felony murder rule. That's exactly what happened. And Mr. MacArthur said, you'll understand it if you just read number two, look at it a little while. But they didn't get that instruction. And in the opposition, the responding brief, the state says, Mr. MacArthur disagreed with the deliberations taking place and made the suggestion that, quote, the middle paragraphs explain the first and third paragraph, how they relate to each other.
I know time is short, but can you slow down just?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Can't hear that fast.
Okay, so this is my last sentence. And the state says, responds to that proffered instruction. However, this suggestion was immediately rejected because it contradicted jury instruction number two, which stated to read the instruction as a whole. But that's exactly what Mr. MacArthur is saying. He's not saying forget about the first two and the last two. He's saying focus your attention on that middle paragraph, and then you'll be able to understand the context of all three of these paragraphs. And that was harmful error because the jury went back and did not understand what they were doing. They're conflating child abuse and the felony murder rule with a total misapprehension and misunderstanding of what the applicable law was in this case.
Could you respond to your colleague's argument that there were two defense counsel and they appeared to reach consensus that a supplemental instruction was not necessary?
Yes, Ms. McNeil was doing the same thing what the state was doing and what the judge was doing is saying essentially, figure it out for yourselves. But to do that, it's an analytical process to figure out because it's thoroughly confusing. And that's what attorneys are for, not jurors, to analyze what is how to break this down and what does it mean. And I talked about that. Mr. MacArthur was silent. He was pretty much mum. And he said, I'm trying to figure it out. And he did figure it out while they were all saying, including Ms. McNeil, because they didn't know. They didn't know what to say. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. All right.